Well, let's begin. I think it's that time. For purposes of the tape ministry, I have to say, why don't you go ahead and get the tape rolling? My name is Jody Kretzman, and this is a session calling Racism, Where Are We and Where Are We Going? That's a topic, it seems to me, that we would be better off spending at least a couple of months on rather than 1 hour. But it's an hour is what we've got, and it's an appropriate time, certainly in the context of Holden Village, to be thinking about race relations, and particularly today about racism. Let me just say a word about what I bring to the table here, and hope that we can, as the period goes along, bring ourselves into a discussion mode, much more than a lecture one. This is the sort of official beginning day of Rainbow on the Mountaintop at Holden. And it's a good day to recall that there are two sides to working on race relations questions in the context of the United States. One side, it seems to me, and this is the side that we're going to be mostly emphasizing, it seems to me, through these 10 days at Holden, one side is positive, invitational, exciting, filled with possibilities, kind of the rainbow images and all of the richness that it can mean to our lives, does mean probably to lots of our lives already, and that it could potentially mean even more, right? So there's that one whole side that is really quite seductive, it seems to me. But the other side of race relations in the United States is a hard collection of truths about who we are and who we've been as a nation. And it seems to me to be a whole village approaching these questions in a whole way. We need to take a look at both of those sides. And the racism window into race relations is, in fact, an invitation for us to at least acknowledge that there's a hard side to the set of questions we're going to be dealing with over the next 10 days. I've come to believe over the last about 28 years or so of working in a variety of settings on some kind of race relations and some kind of racial justice agenda, I've come to believe that Gunnar Myrdal, a great Scandinavian philosopher and social scientist, was absolutely right when in the early 40s he spent lots of time in the United States, talked to lots of people, did some very thorough surveys of attitudes, and went back and wrote his marvelous book, The American Dilemma. The American Dilemma in the early 1940s noted that all the way through the history of the United States, this marvelous kind of experiment in democracy, the one sort of exception, the one part of our public life that we just couldn't get right was race, right? We just couldn't do it. And that it had the character in American life of a dilemma. A dilemma is something that is a box, one sort of image for it, out of which there is no way. That is, we are trapped in this kind of dance, the races in the United States, that have built a kind of box around all of our lives, that have trapped black folks and other people of color, and have trapped the dominant cultures, European cultures, in the same kind of trap, although with very different outcomes and very different kinds of prices to pay for being in that trap. I think Myrdal defined that as well as anybody could. What is that now, 50 years ago? And then a whole lot of his analysis holds true today. If you want to really go back and take a look at a marvelous piece of social science that's actually readable, try An American Dilemma again. Have you read it recently at all? It really stands up. C.T. Vivian, a black minister with whom I do a lot of work on racism in various settings, always starts his racism workshops with reference to Gunnar Myrdal and sort of goes through the typology of different kinds of racists that Myrdal developed in the early 40s, and CT argues that they're still pretty apt, and I think that's probably right. I think, though, that the new American reality that we face in 1990 is beginning to raise for us with some really new urgency both a new set of possibilities and a new kind of kick in the pants to get at it again in terms of racial justice in the United States. Simply put, we're becoming a multicultural society whether we want to or not. Right? Almost a quarter of the population of the United States now made up of Native American, Hispanic, Asian, and African American people. Right? Almost a quarter. Within a decade, a third of the workforce will be people of color. Right? And for more and more of us, it's clear that our fates are intertwined. It's true, that's always been true in the United States. It's also been true, particularly for white Americans, that we've been able to distance it. We've been able to put barriers between us and people of color. And we've succeeded to a large degree in sort of insulating ourselves from both the causes and the effects of our problems. Well, let me say one more thing in introduction and then run through five quick points with you, each of which I hope to get some response on, and open up discussion. The last thing I want to say is I think, at least for purposes of this hour, what I'd like to do is to really concentrate on relationships between white folks and African American folks in the United States. And I want to do that up front without apology, but with a bit of explanation. I recognize, I've just said, that the United States is becoming increasingly a multicultural and a global society. But it does seem to me that there is something absolutely central about black and white relationships in the United States, and that centrality needs to be acknowledged from the get-go. And in fact, that once we begin to understand the complicated and sort of all-encompassing dynamics of black and white, we can then begin to understand how to weave red and brown and yellow people into some kind of a fabric that makes sense. But somehow it seems to me, anyway, that black and white is at the center of our dilemma. And I really want to focus on the dilemma this afternoon. Will you go with me on that? Is that okay? We could talk a little bit about the interesting ways in which Hispanic people, Asian people, Native American people modify our discussion and teach us different ways of thinking about interracial life in the United States. But let's at least start with black and white, okay? Let me start with just one brief way to underline what I think is the urgency of this question. After about three decades of progress in the United States in terms of the relationship between black folks and white folks on a whole series of fronts, the last 10 years has been a disaster. The last 10 years has put us in reverse in a whole lot of ways. And I just want to put up a couple of quick things to remind us of that. I think you're probably all aware of this. Little chart here that I put together called Economics of Black and White. Just to remind us about where we are. Can you see any of this over on that side, or is it at all visible? Can you see it in the back at all? Let me just go through it quickly. I've got four decades here, 60, 70, 80, and then 86 was the last numbers I looked at. And I've just charted out a few things which illustrate basically that the 1980s in particular have been a time of regression in terms both overall of black economic well-being in the United States and of the relationship between blacks and whites in the United States economically. The poverty rate in the African American community in 1960 was 55%. After all the bashing we've done in the 1980s of social programs, the Great Society and War on Poverty programs in the 60s and 70s, it's clear if you look at the poverty rate, by 1970, it had gone from 55 to 32% within the African American community. It pretty much leveled off in the 1970s. Part of that, by the way, is clearly due to the booming economy around the war in Vietnam. It's not all due to the Great Society and War on Poverty programs, but certainly some of it is attributable to that. It levels off in the 1970s, and then the 80s, it begins to creep back up again. So the poverty rate in the black community now is around 36%. We're worse off in the African American community than we were in 1970. The unemployment rate among African American males, right, was 9.6% in 1960, had dipped to 3.7% in 1970, and certainly a lot of that does have to do with the Vietnam War and the scrunch in the economy at that point, need for labor. back up by the early 80s and 82 to almost 19%, and has leveled off now around the 15% mark. And that has regional variations, that has all kinds of variations across the country. But still much higher than it was even in 1960. Something interesting going on there that really cries out for attention. Availability of work for large segments of the black community is just not there anymore. One other quick indicator, the ratio of black family income to white family income. Okay? In 1960, African American families earned 55% on the average of what white families earned. Right? Not a great record. It closed that gap a little bit, so that black families were earning 60% of white family income by 70, and then it started dipping. By the early 80s, it was 56%, and I think now it's about 54%, something like that. So in fact, not only do we have more poor African American people, but we have a gap between white and black that's widening once again. Right? So the overall trend really is some progress up until about 1973 or so, and then a leveling off and then a decline that's taken us through the 80s. I think you can look at a whole lot of other indicators and see basically the same story. If you were to look, for instance, people do studies of residence trends, that is, integration. How much do people live next to each other, people from different races and cultures? And all of the measures of that say that segregation, basically, again, it's a curve remarkably like this one, that integration in a variety of parts of the country, again, this varies from part to part of the country, but basically we were becoming a somewhat more integrated society up until about the early 70s. Then it leveled off, and since then, all of the indicators are, again, that white folks are living more with white folks, and that African American folks are living more with African American folks. I think that, by the way, is a complicated issue, but it's another measure of the kind of separation we're looking at. And finally, I think it's worth saying that everybody who has anything at all to do with relations between the races has been aware of the last 5 years, a steep increase in the amount and severity of racial violence, right? Racial incidents generally, but racial violence in particular. It seems to me that somewhere in the culture of the 1980s, some parts of the white community were getting the message, right, that it was once again okay not only not to like black folks, right, but to act on that dislike in an active way. For a while, the culture said, uh-uh, and set limits on that kind of behavior. But the limits began to lift, and I think where there were all sorts of messages around affirmative action, around picks for the Supreme Court, around a whole lot of the way in which the conversation around civil rights was happening in Washington, D.C., that gave out the signal it's okay to engage in overtly racist behavior, white folks, once again. Do you all have that feeling that there's something different out there in terms of the permission that people have these days, white people have these days? Is that? Okay. Well, that's frightening to me. It's frightening to me because it's not who we ought to be as a Christian people, and it's not who we ought to be as, it seems to me, still an exciting experiment in democracy. Okay, anything else? Did anybody else want to say anything about the way in which the 80s have affected sort of at the macro level? Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I think it looks like most that the violence rate in general has begun going back up, although there's a specific category of criminal activity which is racial violence. And almost all, at least big city police departments and state police departments, now keep those statistics separately, which they didn't used to do. So it's a little hard to deal with their validity. But in that separate category, the rise has been precipitous, not just gradual. White on white crime is up, black on black crime is up. You know, that all of that is true. But the other kind is up really markedly differently. Okay? I think it might be helpful, and I'm sure that lots of you in the room have done this, and I just want to run through it and make sure we're on the same page here. But it might be helpful to get a little bit of definitional clarity on what it is. When I've used the word racism in a title for this little bit of stuff this afternoon, but I'm not sure always that we know what we're talking about when we talk about racism. I want to see whether we can work together to get at least some clarity about some different ways of going at this. I've put four terms on the sheet here, which sometimes overlap and sometimes get confused with each other. And I want to just see if we can work for a second together at arriving at some consensus about what the differences are among these. The four terms are prejudice, cultural arrogance, racism, and institutional racism. Okay? A lot of you I know have done this for a long time, but let's just get some definitions on the floor to make sure that we're kind of on the same page. Somebody help me with prejudice. What's prejudice?
Feeling of superiority, one race to another.
Non-acceptance of something or someone that is different,
mm-hmm.
without having a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a preconceived notion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're building a good one. Anybody else?
It's generally enculturated in the individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me try a collection of some. I think they're all contained in this one. Let me just try a collection on you and see whether we're talking about attitudes or opinions, right? Attitudes or opinions, enculturated probably, especially of a hostile nature, based on prejudgment and insufficient information. Prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people. Attitudes or opinions based on prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people. Is that workable? We stay with that on prejudice? Okay. Cultural arrogance.
Thinking that your group or ethnic group is the best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That certainly could be a form of it, yeah.
Yeah. Telling of Norwegian jokes.
All right. And no others, right?
White man's burden?
Yeah, I think that's probably a form of it, sure. Sure. We've got all the answers and we need to spread them, right? Other elements? Let me try out a quick one on you that some folks were working on. Within the United States, anyway, the uplifting of the Anglo-American or white European style of life and values so that racial and ethnic groups are defined by Anglo-American standards. It's white man's burden, I suppose, another way to put that. So that other racial and ethnic groups are defined by Anglo-American standards. There's one set of standards, and you either live up to them or you don't, right? The result of this is the exclusion of the beauty and richness and values experienced in other cultures. So the last sentence sort of talks about the impoverishment of the mainstream culture through cultural arrogance, right? That's one of the things I think we're about here at Rainbow on the Mountaintop, is to begin to experience the kind of richness that can come out of some interactions. Okay? All right, help me out with racism then. If we've got prejudice and cultural arrogance down pat, what do we mean by racism?
I think racism adds the element of power.
Okay. Okay.
I think I read this in Vanguard recently. It said, racism is prejudice with power.
Yeah. That's the definition that Lutheran Human Relations Association and lots of us have been working on for the last...
Makes less, huh?
Yeah. Think about that. Prejudice, we've got prejudice, right? Plus power. Prejudice plus power. Prejudice plus power. You can sort of play that out a little bit. Any attitude, action, or institutional practice which subordinates people because of their color. Okay. Now, prejudice plus power raises an interesting question. Some of you probably will anticipate the question. Can black folks be racist in the United States? Let's have a little discussion.
Lewis Farrakhan, keeping blacks, both blacks, and not diluting the race with, you know, all the...
I can't hear.
You know, all the
say it a little bit louder.
Mm-hmm. And all his beliefs about separating blacks, and that now blacks should be above whites. Don't dilute the race. There should be no interaction, but not no marriages. No, you dilute the race by if a black man marries a white woman, he's diluting the next children down, and pretty soon there's not going to be enough black culture. And he's a nonviolent, but he's really. His beliefs are really a lot of separatism.
Let's remember our definition. What's racism?
Prejudice
plus power. How would you talk about within the context of the United States where a Louis Farrakhan is in terms of the kind of power he holds? He's clearly a leader, and lots of people listen.
He's nonviolent power, but you can have power without the violence. He's got power over minds,
mm-hmm.
the way he speaks, and he has a lot of influence,
mm-hmm.
a lot of followers.
Mm-hmm.
He's a captive.
Some of the rest of you, you want to leap into the discussion?
The area of... blacks, the different shades of blackness. Some lighter colored black people feel superior over darker colored.
So there are gradations within the black community, a variety of different kind of complicated relations based on skin color and income and anything else. Like within any other group, I suspect, right? How about the prejudice plus power question, though? Interesting that the first example came up was Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam. What do you think?
What kind of power blacks have?
Mm-hmm.
Street power?
Coming up with the
gangs.
Laws.
I saw when I lived in Detroit how blacks used what power they did have against the Arabs that were coming in. I rode with black police officers, and they expressed to me how it was against their beliefs to allow Arabs into their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And so they turned their backs sometimes when crime was going on against Arabs, and they admitted to it because they deserved it. It was their neighborhood.
Clearly, there are some instances in which there are clashes that involve African Americans defining themselves over against other folks, whether Farrakhan or clashes about businesses within the black community.
Right? Do the right thing.
Do the right thing, that's right. That's a movie about clashes within the black community. Yeah, yeah. Now let's back off for just a minute. Tell me how many of the CEOs of the Fortune 500 are black. Tell me how many bishops of the Lutheran Church are black. One, by the way. The answer is, it's not none. Tell me how many governors are black. now one, I think.
There's three.
Is there three now?
Virginia.
Oh, no.
I think only one. Wasn't he the only one at this point? Yeah, Dinkins. There are certainly more and more black mayors of major American cities. But it is still true that although the number of black elected officials is now up to about 7,000, that represents under 2% of all of the elected officials in the United States. Under 2%, even though we've had incredible gains in the number of black elected officials over the last 15 years. I'm suggesting that if we back off for just a minute, it seems to me unalterably true that all of the major levers of power in the United States are white controlled. All of them. Now, if you're working in a context that is multiracial, I think it's real important to deal with sort of lower gradations of power. What it means to work in the context where Louis Farrakhan really is respected and has a lot of sway over folks, because that's a day-to-day issue then. But when you back off entirely, and particularly for those of us in this room who are white, it seems to me pretty dishonest to spend much time worrying about power questions without recognizing that almost everything we're talking about is white-controlled and white-defined. And that, in fact, the Korean black community problem, the Arab black community problem, both of those things we're dealing with all the time in my hometown of Chicago, and I'm sure you all are in Washington and various others, Detroit, that those problems are about really scraping for the crumbs off the master's table, right? The scrambling for stuff that's down there that really is not at the center of control of our kind of society, right? It really is folks scrambling around and pitting themselves against each other over resources that really aren't huge, right? They're really about corner grocery stores. What was Do the Right Thing about, right? It was about a corner pizzeria, you know, that barely scraped by. It wasn't about General Motors. So I guess for me, what I'm saying is I'm not going to go to the mat and say I don't think blacks can be racist. Some of my friends do that, and I won't go to the mat and say that. But I will say for me, as a white guy in the United States, the only kind of racism that matters, and the only kind that I'm going to spend any time worrying about, is white racism, because that's the context that defines everything else. So for me, it's also my job, I think, to work more on that end of things than in the black community. Sarah?
I think that we could say that you would find prejudice among African Americans.
Absolutely.
But because of that whole issue of power, it isn't justifiable to say that African-American people are also racist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we do live in a racist society.
Yeah. That's right. And what I'm just trying to underline, very simple here, is when we say we live in a racist society, what we're really saying is we live in a white racist society, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the prejudice question, Sarah. I don't know, go back to the definition, at least, that I've sort of read after people. Attitudes or opinions, hostile ones, based on prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people, the African-American community, about white folks. But it's also clear to me that black folks know a hell of a lot more about white folks than vice versa, right?
It's called survival.
That's right. That's right. So that, in fact, there's less, I think, probably, of the prejudice.
In a way, you're talking about judging a group, judging one person based on the group
mm-hmm.
of people they come from, as opposed to, judging, I mean, in
after
that
getting
case,
to know somebody.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Are you on board at all with this? Is it okay, at least for me, to say that for me, white racism is what's important, right? And in this culture, it's what's, I think, worth working on, right? Let me go a little bit further just in terms of my own self-definition then. And just let me speak as a white guy here. I don't think that growing up as a white guy in the United States, that there's any way that I can be a non-racist. Let me just say that again. I don't think that there's any way, growing up in the culture and institutions of the United States, that I can be a non-racist. What I can do, because, let me just say one or two because no matter what's inside my head, every time I act in the society, I act in the context of white institutions, and I am acted upon as if I am white, because I'm white. So is everybody else in this room who's white. I don't have anything to say about that. Therefore, all of the common practices of the United States that are racially defined act on me as a white person differently than they act on Sarah as a black person. So I am caught up fully in the racist identity of the culture. This is my view. What I think I can be, though, I can't be a non-racist. What I think I can be is an anti-racist. What I think I can be is an actor against racism. That doesn't mean I'm a non-racist. You understand what I'm trying to... My identity in this culture as a white person is racist. Right? But I can act as an anti-racist. It's a distinction that's important to me. I don't know whether it's important to anybody else here. Partly because it seems to me part of the reality, and those of you in the room who are Lutherans with me will know the importance of this. It does seem to me that we are at home as Lutherans, living as a confessional people, right? And I think there's nothing at all wrong with confessing racism, right? And starting from there, I, a poor, miserable racist, right? Got a friend in Chicago who started a 12-step group called Racist Anonymous, right? Mm-hmm. I am Jody, I'm a racist. Mm-hmm. How you work on that with different kinds of... Part of the reason I say that has to do then with, let's work on this last set of definitions, institutional racism. Help me out here. What do we mean by institutional racism?
Publishing of educational books.
Okay, there's an example.
Other cultures.
There's an example, right? Publishing industry, the education system.
On the job racism.
Yeah. Company. Labor market and employment practices, all that. We've got some examples on the table. Anybody want to start? We're going to try a generalization.
Systems and procedures that work to the benefit of one group and opposed to the benefit of another.
I like that. What do you all think about that? Say that again.
systems and procedures that work to the benefit of one group and opposed to the benefit of another, or against the welfare of another, well-being of another.
How's that sound? You say it a different way. Policies and practices of basic institutions. Policies and practices of basic institutions. For example, business, healthcare, education, publishing, government, religion, which result in benefits to people of one race at the expense of those of other races.
Don't forget the media.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Policies and practices of basic institutions. You know what that means? What that means is that we are all part the set of institutions which define our reality, right? Have normal ways of practicing. Normal policies and practices, everyday stuff. As long as we are part of those institutions and we do what's normal, what's expected of us, this definition says we are probably acting within a racist context. That the exceptional activity is that activity which is anti-racist. Okay. I think that it's at least arguable that institutional racism is the bedrock of what we're talking about here. So I want to just spend another quick minute on institutional racism. The other reason I want to do this is because it has seemed to me that institutional racism is the hardest nut for Americans to crack. I mean, we have all been brought up to be sort of militantly personalistic and individualistic in the way we understand the world and ourselves in it, right? I get college students and even graduate students who all the time basically think, what is there here? What is reality? Reality is me and the cosmos, right? And there's not much in between, right? There's pretty much me and the cosmos. I mean, there's some good Protestantism in that, right? There's, I suppose. But there are real mediating institutions in the world, right? It's not just me and the cosmos. But particularly Americans, it seems to me, we are as a people probably the most illiterate of first world countries, the most illiterate people in the world about institutions and social structures, right? We have this sort of militant belief that all individuals are just bundles of free choices that we make all the time, which is absolute baloney. Therefore, let me just say a word about institutional racism. This is, let me just, as a way, this, we can do an awful lot on this, but let me give you one quick way that has been helpful for me to think about this in a city context, which is where I do a lot of my work. A friend of mine about 20 years ago first wrote an article, and we've been working on it ever since, called The Web of Urban Racism, that has been helpful for me in thinking about what institutional racism is. The web of urban racism is the image is a spider web. The image is a spider web, and the image is the fly caught in the middle of the spider web. And the fly caught in the middle of the spider web is the African American or black community. Right? How does this work? And it's clearly not the whole African American community. Not everybody in the African American community is caught in the middle of institutional webs all of the time. But one quick and simple-minded way of understanding how this works is, we just picked six to start with here: the jobs, institutions, the workplace, welfare, healthcare, media. We did get that in this time. Housing, education. Basically, each of these institutions is in fact two sets of institutions. One major set of institutions, which is white-owned and controlled, and which benefits whites. And one secondary set of institutions and mechanisms that is also often white owned and controlled, but is aimed at the black community. So that, for instance, in the jobs area, people talk about the functioning of a dual labor market, right? There are really two ways to get into the labor market, to get into the job force. And the way in which that works is different for folks from the African American community than it is for white folks. The networks are different. The degrees are different. The educational background is different. The way, you know, people get jobs by who they know, mostly, right? A lot of it is that. It's also true, though, that increasingly in the last 15 years, the parts of the economy that have been growing in a kind of dual way. At the top, you've got some jobs that are high-paying and that require an increasing amount of education, and they go about 95% to white folks. At the bottom, you've got a whole bunch of jobs, the McDonaldization of the economy, the McDonald's jobs, that are low-paying, dead-end, require little or no skill or education, have no future, and they go predominantly to people of color. So you've got, you can really talk about a dual labor market, two ways of getting in, two ways to define the job. I think the same thing is true in something like media. City like Chicago, you've got the mainstream white media that has the illusion of being universal, the Tribune, the Sun-Times, the major radio and TV stations. And you've got a kind of small community-based African-American community press, right? Housing, dual labor markets. The difference in where people live is the difference in how housing gets distributed as a good in the society. Education, major two-track system. Increasingly, people of color occupy public schools which are failing in the inner cities, and white folks occupy suburban or private or parochial schools. Healthcare, clearly a growing gap in the health statistics between black community and white community members. So that what you've got is systems that are operating in their ordinary way that distribute benefits differently to black folks and white folks. And they do that just, again, as a normal course of business. When you're stuck in here in the middle, the problem is, how do you get out? Problem is, how do you get out? Where do you start? Lots of folks say, well, let's do education. Let's educate folks. The problem is, if you educate folks and there are no jobs, why will they stay in school? Is there any incentive at all? If you aim at education and you can't get nutrition enough into the household to allow people to get to school, how can we educate folks, right? If there's not enough money for a family to exist on welfare, how can we expect the education system to work? If the housing is falling down around the family's ears, how's a parent gonna prioritize an education for a kid? Problem is, all of these institutions are intertwined. They're a web that lock in particularly folks who are now increasingly isolated. That's not true, again, of all of the African American community, but it's true of an increasing sort of set, it seems to me, of poor people, people of color, and not just African Americans. In fact, some white folks as well are in the middle of that kind of institutional set. But that's a trap, and it's a trap that's almost impossible to think one's way out of. Is that at all, are you at all with me on this? Is that at all clear about what I'm talking about in terms of institutional racism? Are we there?
I also think that we're looking at the expansion of the class system in our country.
That's right.
Not only racially motivated or racially based, I think that the economically based, the people who are able to be involved in the better jobs or the better government and better company perks in terms of 401 programs and people who can save in IRAs and people who own houses now and have the opportunity to take advantage of the tax consequences and the savings plans are able to do that, and the people who are just scraping by are not able to do that, and this division is growing very rapidly. And in our part of the world, in Southern California, people who do not help their children buy a house, typically their children will never be able to own a home.
Yeah.
Not in our marketplace.
Yeah.
So we're seeing this class system develop very, very definitely in our country, not necessarily along racial, but more along economic basis.
Yeah. You know, social scientists have tried for years to untangle the question, is it race or is it class? You know, is it economics or is it racism that's causing that is behind the escalation of poverty? And I'm not sure that's any more even that productive a question, because the two are so intertwined, and they're not intertwined just by accident. I mean, it's no accident that there is a higher percentage of people of color in poverty than white folks. But that's right. I mean, you can't ever forget the economic dynamics. We okay on the institutional racism for a moment? I'm going to open up entirely here for just in just a moment. I just want to say the last sort of cluster of things I want to just say briefly is about white responses to racism. I said a little bit before about what I thought was a good starting point, at least for me, but it does seem to me that there are at least three classic white responses to racism, which are not terrifically helpful. And I've always found it sort of helpful to remember these, just in case I fall into them myself, and to know them when I hear them. I hear them all the time with my white students around. I'm beginning to understand that there is white racism around, and I'm beginning to understand that we've got a problem here, but I'm different. I'm an individual. Please look at me as who I am. I am Jody. Please look at me as an individual. Don't lump me in with everybody else. My intentions are pure. This is a kind of exceptionalism, right? An attempt by me or anybody else to sort of back out of identity that we were fortunately and unfortunately born with. Right? Please not me. Right? I really am different. I really do care. And it's a kind of exceptionalism, it seems to me, that's not very helpful, usually. I mean, I understand the psychology of it because I'm tempted to do it myself all the time. But it's not very helpful to say that to our African-American brothers and sisters. Because everybody will say it to them, and they get a little bit tired of it, I think, probably. Another common, and I think equally unhelpful response by white folks is what I might call universalism. That is, and I, Christian young folks particularly like to do this one. Aren't we all really one under the skin? Right? Skin color really doesn't make any difference, does it? Didn't Jesus die for all of us? And really, aren't we all the same in the most important things in life, in the most important human ways? Aren't we all human beings? Now that's true. That's true. At one very both simple and profound level. But I'm arguing that it's also pretty unhelpful, that it doesn't get us very far in terms of dealing with, in fact, the way the society has separated us out from each other, right? I might say, rather, that because we're all one, because we are all, in fact, one human family, my job is to recognize the racial divisions as sharply as I possibly can and to say, look, I'm going to tell you right now that I'm white and you better not trust me, right, unless I earn it, right? We're not the same. This society has told us we're different. And we have to deal with that as part of being honest to each other. Right, Sarah? So universalism, it seems to me, is an equally unhelpful response. And finally, I think the third unhelpful response on the part of white folks is to sort of sink into rampant guilt. Right. And go around in effect a constant sort of guilty state of mind for being part of a racist culture and society, and that seems to me clearly not helpful. We need to move through, it seems to me, through confession to understanding to commitment. Some kind of a progression from, and bringing us back to confession probably constantly, but confession to understanding to commitment, have that sort of circle going fairly consistently in our lives in order to be helpful in this area. The last thing I want to say, and then I really do want to get some feedback on any of this, I've been trying to be gloomy. Pretty gloomy for the last little while, and I'm not sure that I'm convinced that the situation is entirely hopeless. Sometimes I think that. I certainly thought that, having given about 5 or 6 years of my life to the black political empowerment movement in my own city and worked with our good friend Harold Washington while he was mayor of Chicago, I certainly went through a year of sort of total despair after his untimely death. And I think there are probably events in people's lives who are engaged in this kind of work that sort of throw us back into despair constantly on a daily basis. It doesn't have to be the death of a leader. But I do see constant signs of hope, along with, and I said this the other night, and I just, along with the escalation in racial violence in the United States, I see more and more people who are committed to changing things. More and more white people. I think it's really exciting that the ELCA and other church bodies have decided to at least begin the attempt to expand themselves into multicultural churches. And I think for me, on a daily basis, the hundreds and hundreds of examples of good local work that builds work around which black folks and white folks and other people can get through the barriers, overcome the distrust, and work together on questions of justice. I see that all over the place. I see it all over the place, and I'm really excited by it. And if some of you, I hope in the few minutes that remain, might want to share a couple of those stories or get into this discussion in any other place, let me stop. I've gone on for too long. enter into the discussion any place you want to, disagree with me on anything, or if you want to, share a sign of hope or two. Mm-hmm.
One thing I was thinking about the economic standpoint between blacks and whites and how the government's work with the economy has made such a gap between them. And if, and in the last year with all the changes in Eastern Europe, the American attitude towards the military is that, well, the things have changed, but the attitude towards the military has lessened. But the government still puts a lot of money into the military when a lot of Americans feel that we could put that back, use that money to, and we could use it to close the gaps in the economy by not cutting so many social programs, but not cutting health care, not cutting Social Security, which have been cut before to pay for the military.
Mm-hmm.
So if the government can use that money for something else and work on our own problems at home, it might start closing that, and as the gap closes, maybe it'll end some part of the racism, some of the prejudice put together as it closes.
Yeah, that's an important point, I think. It seems to me that the understanding in Washington, D.C. over the last 15 years about what national security really means has been entirely upside down, you know. And it seems to me, as you travel around the world, what people are impressed with always about the United States is the experiment we are in democracy and multicultural living, right? And when they are impressed with us is when we're really working on that in a visible and full-speed forward kind of way. They're not, you know, they're fearful of us when we've got all our nuclear weapons pointed at them, but they're not sort of in awe of the experiment here. And when we're working on it full speed ahead is when we've got the sort of interest and intrigue of the rest of the world. The peace dividend is a huge opportunity, both to make sure that it exists and then to find productive ways to work on these questions with them.
You bring that up, though. There's an interesting downside to that. I've got a brother who's a lieutenant colonel in the Army.
Yeah.
And we've been talking, he just came back, he lives in Atlanta, and was saying that probably in the next 2 years the Army may be laying off as many as 500,000 people.
Right.
And I suspect, I don't know what the statistics are on that, but I suspect a good portion of those are black people.
That's right.
And the retooling and all of that that is going to need to take place, it could very well end up being another form of institutional bias. You know, this great peace dividend, but where does it leave a lot of these people who have bought into the system in the sense that, you know, here's Colin Powell, who's finally have a black Joint Chief of Staff head, and you know, what's going to happen to those folks? It's an interesting dilemma.
It is an interesting dilemma, although I think we have to keep in mind, though, that all of the, everything we know about how to create jobs tells us
sure.
that you can create 3 jobs in the civilian sector
sure.
for every one, for the same amount of money, for every one
in
you
time.
Create in the military.
In
but
time.
It'll take some time yeah. to get there. That's right. Yeah.
You know, I think the response here, you know, coming from Chicago, you're coming from a very different place than I'm sure some of us in the room are.
Sure. Sure.
I would say the common white response that I would hold up is, well, you know, this doesn't affect me because I don't live in an area where there are any black people.
That's right. That ought to be probably the fourth.
Minorities are very, you know, they're really a minority.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they, you know.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? That's really right. I mean, that should be the fourth response I've got down here on this list. So what's the problem is the response, right?
I think it's a lack of awareness. I work with some black individuals, and I just listen to them and their experiences. I mean, they can't even drive downtown to go to a restaurant at night without having to think of what the consequences may be of running into someone who's a racist. I mean, they go through things daily that you and I would never consider. They don't take anything for granted.
That's right.
And, I mean, so I think it's really a lack of not being aware, ignorance, and not being insensitive to really what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you made a good point the other night that stuck. I never thought of before that you and I have a choice, and the black people don't in intercultural relationships. I think that's important.
That's right.
No.
That's right.
I do think you are seeing a number of changes in the workplace in major industry today, recognizing that we're in for some tough sledding economically, especially with some of these defense programs and things being cut back. But I know in California that there are a tremendous number of people in the middle management area, still not the CEO level, but who've been on the job for a period of time, and as a result of some of the social programs and some of the educational programs that they have been able to equip themselves with tools to join the middle management portion of the workforce. And in our company, at the middle management level, there are a significant number of minority people, not necessarily black, but minorities as a whole. And I don't think it's a quota relationship. I think it's, in many instances, these people were the best trained for the job, had the best capability or qualifications for it. And I see more and more of that. I don't see it at the top, and I don't see any indication from the top of our company, as an example, that there's necessarily going to be an overabundance of upper-level growth. But at the middle management level, we do see a lot more people of color in middle management than we ever did before.
Well, that's hopeful. I'm not sure that that's true all the way across the economy, but it's hopeful to see some places it's happening. Great.
I think the point that was raised on the other side there about the fourth issue is a really important one, because I live in a black city. 70% of people in Washington are black. I work for a social service agency, a Lincoln social service agency, where 2/3 of my staff are black, where all of my club managers are black. I live in a city where United Way has two categories, minority and non-minority. Okay. And we use terms here in different kinds of ways. And part of it is just getting that fourth, a lot of folks in the Lutheran Church who are in that fourth category, where what's the issue? Recognizing there is an issue, folks, and that it's a worldwide issue, because we're only a tiny piece of the world. And most of the world, the majority of the world, is not like us.
That's right.
And how do we get ourselves to really sense that?
Mm-hmm.
And invite you to come to Washington and live in the city for a while, because it's a different world.
Yep.
A very different world. Chicago, Detroit, yep. Other places like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder about a church that says it wants to be inclusive, and yet I don't see a lot happening.
Right.
And I wonder where the votes are.
Mm-hmm.
It really struck me that you said, unless you're actively anti-racist, you're really supporting racism. Unless you actively do something to defeat racism and to change society, then in a way you're supporting the perpetuation of institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
We all do have to contribute in some way, or it looks like
we
get bigger.
Mm-hmm. Part of the strategy, too, I think, is to seduce white folks into it. I mean, to be able to share, and that's part of what Rainbow is about, to try to share some of the joys of expanding monocultural kind of outlooks, right? And some of the joys of interacting with the rest of the globe, that's the 89% of the globe that is people of color, right? That's both realistically our context, and it's exciting. It really is exciting. And we do have an opportunity, it seems to me, in this country, more of an opportunity than any place else in the world, to make that work and to work on it.
I just want to add a final comment. It seems like the big dilemma is how do you force change when you have a capitalistic economy or society. I mean, it goes back to the same rule that who has the gold makes the rules. And right now, the white society has all the gold, basically. And so, I mean, how do you force social change in a capitalistic system? That just the two, kind of tolerate each other, or actually don't tolerate each other. Most of the people who are in the business world refuse change. They want the market to operate on its own, function on its own, without this artificial injection of social change and social justices. And it's an impossible task, really.
just because of the fact, again, like, you know, who has the gold makes the rules.
Well, I guess what I would say about that is that that in fact we're not caught in an absolutely ahistorical moment. I mean, we're flowing through changes all the time.